There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the McClifford Podcast with the Irish Examiner. Now, the big story this week has been the publication of the final report into the mother and baby homes and related matters. It's been a very emotional time for survivors of these homes in particular, and a time of great reflection at the very least for an awful lot of people in the population. It's nearly 3,000 pages long, and it goes into the details of conditions in the homes, the attitudes both inside the homes and among wider society towards single women who were pregnant, and it goes into detail around the processes that led many babies to be adopted, most babies practically, well over 95% or so at one stage. Just a few quick figures to give you an idea of what's involved. Over 9,000 babies died in these homes between 1922 and 1998. 56,000 women went through them and 57,000 babies were born, the vast majority, as I say, of whom were adopted, some in disputed circumstances. Now, those figures apply just to the 18 homes that were examined in the report. There are a number of county homes as well that weren't part of it, and the estimate is that a further 25,000 women went through those. In the round, it's a harrowing narrative of a very dark chapter in this country's history. I think there's been two dominant themes to emerge from a lot of the reporting and comment. One is what exactly can be done to relieve the burden of survivors and meet the kind of needs that they have. And the other has been, I suppose, a reflection on the kind of country that allowed this to happen and where exactly culpability lies for it. Joining me to discuss the report and the fallout is Dr. Catherine O'Donnell, Associate Professor in the School of Philosophy in UCD. Catherine also works with the Justice for Magdalen Research, which advocates for Magdalen Laundry survivors. Catherine, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mick. Good to be here.
Catherine, you've worked for a long time in this whole area of where women and young girls were, I suppose, victims of the state, of cultural and religious life in this country through a long part of the 20th century. What's your general reaction to the publication this week?
Well, in some ways, I'm as you know, Mick, a little bit reluctant to be on the podcast because as an academic, speaking about a report that I haven't read is a sin. and I haven't read it. And I want to kind of state that clearly. I have read the executive summary. I have read the recommendations. And I have read part four, which is the what I'm going to call a weird, from my point of view, amalgam of bits and bobs and scraps and paragraphs of excerpts from people who gave witness testimony. And so my reaction to the report has to be very partial in that regard. I can't really talk about it in detail. So that's the first reaction. Lots of caveats there. The second reaction is great. We have it from my point of view. And this might sound kind of cruel because I am also somebody who's not directly affected in that I'm not adopted. My mother said she often wants to sit me down and tell me that I'm not adopted. What am I doing worrying about adoption? But I'm worried about adoption as an Irish feminist. And I also, I'm thankfully not somebody who has lost a child or children to adoption. So in that sense, I've no skin in the game. But my reaction to the report, therefore, is somebody who can just say, OK, great, that's over and done with. Because this commission, from my point of view, has merely been about the state wanting to tell some kind of story to itself about what it was involved in throughout a lot of the 20th century. And I'm glad that process is over, so now we can actually talk concretely about the 21st century and no longer dwell in history, as it were, but actually dwell in the pressing needs and issues that adopted people and their natural parents have, because these are real live issues. So now we can talk about the present and how we'd like to have a republic in the future. So from that point of view, I welcome this report.
Yeah, and you mentioned there, it's an interesting observation that the commission was largely about forming a narrative or a story of what was life was like then. But to that extent, Catherine, do you think it wasn't primarily about looking for answers and perhaps justice for those who were through that system?
Not at all. Just look at the structure of the report, Mick. You know, they didn't know what to do with the testimony that came to them. It's dangling in part four. They even have paginated it kind of from page one to 200 and something. So it's outside the bulk of the report. So in other words, the people directly affected, adopted people and their parents, specifically their mothers who spent time in these institutions, were not central. So there was no fact-finding from the point of view of the witnesses who were directly impacted by the awful processes of coerced adoption. And, you know, as Conrad Bryan of Mixed Race Irish Group says, that the Irish state seems to want to investigate buildings rather than what's going on for its people. The very fact that they just picked a number of institutions rather than the whole entire kind of apparatus of what happened unwed single mums and their babies just, for me, always spoke volumes.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a very good point. And I mean, I suppose, as you say, they picked a number of institutions. There's an estimate there's 25,000 other women, presumably at least a portion of whom are still alive, who were in the other homes. And, you know, you could argue they were randomly excluded from the whole process.
Yeah, I mean, there were also women who gave birth in hospitals, and certainly middle-class women who were private patients. And we have one of the biggest agencies, the St. Patrick's Guild Agency, not examined at all, for example. So there were a lot of adoption agencies that completely fall out of the remit of this institutional gaze. And even the apology, which I, again, from my point of view, I thought was a very good apology by Micheál Martin, and certainly compared to his predecessors, Enda Kenny and Cowan and Ahern, I thought it was a full and substantial and very sincere apology. But he never mentioned adopted people. He mentioned survivors of institutions. And I can't fault him from that, because that's what this commission was about. But I can fault the setting up of a commission to examine various institutions rather than the matter at hand. What do adopted people need? And we have a huge percentage of adopted people. There's at least 55,000 since 1952. So if you multiply that by the two natural parents and then multiply it by the adoptive families, that's a very big section of our population that is actually directly affected by, and I'm going to say it again, coercive adoption system in 20th century Ireland. Part of my kind of, you know, beginning quibbles with this report is they have, I think, kind of clangers, just reading the executive summary. They say in one sentence, there was no evidence of forced adoption. And the very next sentence is, but there was no alternative for these women. And again, they're very anxious to call all of these mothers women. And they have to admit that for one institution, a quarter of these so-called women were women under the age of 18. We call them girls. So the girls and women that gave birth in these institutions are the state, through this report, wants us to believe that they weren't forced to give up their babies. They were certainly coerced. There was no alternative.
Yeah, I think it's a small thing there, Catherine. I think when they said there was no alternative, I think specifically the reference there was to these women and girls going in to have their babies in there. But the point you make is very valid, because there's one stat there for the year 1967, which one would have thought things might have been opening up a small bit. You're talking about 97.9% of all children born so-called outside of wedlock were adopted, which basically meant there was no choice really once you went in, as you say, and the pressure was put on to adopt. One quick thing before we just go on to the adoptees themselves and their families. As you said yourself, and you gave the caveat about not having read the report, there was a certain amount of controversy around the fact that Micheál Martin gave this apology the day after publication, the day after particularly the survivors and everybody who had skin in the game, so to speak, had first seen the report and would be in no position to read and digest 3,000 pages. I mean, that would seem in some ways to fall into this thing you're talking about, that let's just write out the story of what happened rather than dealing with the actual people.
Yeah, again, you know, I have sympathy for Micheál Martin, because if he didn't apologise, we would now be calling for an apology.
Maybe so, yeah.
So he had read it. It had been with Cabinet for a while. And there's definitely things to apologise for. I think he gave a much better apology even than the report would warrant. Again, just having read the recommendations and the executive summary. So, you know, he did have to make an apology, and we all know this. It is going to take a while for us to digest this report. But again, you know, without somebody with skin in the game, without being somebody who's directly affected, I'm just happy to leave aside this report, to read it, take time over the summer to think about it from an academic point of view. I'm going to be reading it. Well, how is the state trying to wriggle off the hook that it really should be on? And I think, again, just from a cursory reading of the executive summary, I'll have loads of material here, because we can see the report states one thing, like there is no other country in the world where pregnant women emigrated in such substantial numbers to another country. And then the next sentence, it says, many Irish people emigrated.
I saw that.
You know.
Yeah. Is that a fair caveat to put in there, though, Catherine? I mean, I wondered about that when I saw it, and I thought what you thought, and then I thought, well, the tradition of immigration was here. I don't know. The one I really gets to me, though, is there would seem to be a huge conflict in terms of survivors who've spoken about the issue of forced adoptions. And what exactly is forced? If practically everybody who's in there has a baby that ends up adopted, does that suggest it's forced of itself, particularly when the women themselves talk about the kind of pressure they were put under?
Yeah, and that takes me, again, just, you know, the lack of definition of terms, the lack of definition of concepts. For example, there's in the introduction, which I found very difficult to make sense of, there's a very curious kind of paragraph where somebody is saying that she didn't see any evidence of trafficking of babies. And then she goes on to describe trafficking as, in other words, she saw no evidence that parents were being groomed to give birth to babies which were being taken and sold into adoption. Okay, well, that's one definition of trafficking. What's the definition of trafficking by the Commission report? We don't have it. And we don't have a clear, remarkably, we don't have a clear definition from them about what constitutes consent. We don't have a definition for them, a legal definition, or even just a plain working definition of their commission, what constitutes force. And they also have this really, really curious parsing of the difference between the church and state and this thing they're calling society. So they want us to believe there's three different things happening in Ireland. There's society, which seems to be there before the state and before the church, and that they actually position the church as not inventing any of the morals or mores by which people live. They actually have sentences saying that. The church is merely reinforcing what society already thinks about prudent ways to manage a family. I'm just there going, guys, that's such poor history writing. You know, we are formed through institutions of church and state. The 20th century society wasn't there something pure and extant without the institutions of church and state. It came into being through the working together of a symbiotic dyad of church and state. But it's in this parsing apart of church, state, and then society that they get to say society is to blame. So the state doesn't have to take a blame. The church doesn't have to be blamed. It is us, all of us who partied, all of us who lived in the 20th century. Strangely enough, we're to blame. Again, Carlo Romani, who's the current ombudsman on children, professor of law in UCC, has done a brilliant job of demolishing this. You know, that we cannot talk about society as if it's something that's anterior to the forces of church and state.
Yes, very true. And I noticed that it's in there as well. In the executive summary, there's a reference to there is no evidence that either church or state forced these women into the homes, but that they had nowhere else to go and it was a form of refuge, and that in the first instance, families were to blame. Now, having said that, Catherine, just coming at it slightly differently, is it not the case that through the culture, through the power of the church at the time, that, and I accept totally what you say about what exactly society might have constituted at the time, but let's say the population in general, that to a certain extent, if you were to use language that we use today, there was an othering among the population in general, perhaps, of people like pregnant, unmarried mothers on the basis that they were outside the fold, if you know what I mean. I mean, is there something in that? Is there culpability there? Or is it simply that population in general were, I don't know, effectively brainwashed by the prevailing hold of the church?
You know, 95% of the current national schools in Ireland are Catholic Church run, still. And if you want to get your child in there, particularly into a national school in Dublin, north or south of the Liffey, you need that baptismal cert. And then they're making the Holy Communion, and then they're making the confirmation. And even still in the 21st century, we can see an awful lot of our cultural attitudes, even though we might think we're post the church, being still inherited through a Catholic church. And I'm one of these people who's not necessarily against that. You know, I'm not kind of, you know, saying we should have secular education even. That's not my issue. My issue is that we have to admit that we are formed through our education and through the kinds of values that we absorb in our culture and society. So we live in a culture and society where the Angelus is rung on our national broadcaster at noon and at 6 p.m. Again, I'm one of these people who actually likes that. But don't tell me that we're post-Catholic Church or that we can't understand that our culture and society, particularly in the 20th century, was a theocracy, was absolutely saturated. Everything that passed for common sense was Catholic, Orthodox thinking, and they had an awful lot to say about the reproductive, social and sexual lives of girls and women. So they focused very much on reproducing a Catholic population by, if you like, you use the word brainwashing, by educating us all around what were the duties of a girl and woman. And she had to be chaste, monogamously married to a man, and she's going to bring up those children, and she'll have many, many children for the church state. And anything outside that fold was going to be punished, and punished severely. One of the things that the report seems to kind of allude to in some ways in its mentions of Irish women, pregnant Irish women fleeing Ireland in ways that we don't see in any other country in the world. We can also see this in kind of general terms about the emigration of Irish women in the 20th century. So Irish women are unique in all of the mass migrations of the world to places like the USA and the UK, in moving into these countries not being part of families. So in other words, they're not daughters or they're not wives. They come as single women and they have single female chain migration. They sent back for other unmarried women in their communities or in their extended families, and helped them emigrate. We don't see any other nation in the world where its female populations are emigrating at larger numbers than the men and are emigrating in this female single chain migration. 20th century Ireland was an incredibly hostile place for all women and girls. And again, we do have some notices of that even in the executive summary. So the mother and baby home system, and I'm going to say coerced adoption of the babies of unmarried girls and mothers, is part of the massive Catholic state pressures which resulted in huge reproductive injustices for women. And one of the things we don't have very clearly in the report, though I think there will be, it will be useful for people like me who, unfortunately, rather late in my career, I'm finally beginning to think about class in Ireland. Finally. I mean, it's one of the big failures of Irish academia, of those of us working in the humanities and social sciences. We haven't really been able to talk about class. Because when you think about class as it's discussed in other academic studies of other cultures and societies, they're able to talk about it in terms of financial terms. Whereas in Ireland, middle class, working class, poor, nobody had money for a lot of disposable or much disposable income in the 20th century. But we did do class, and we did do class largely in terms of our cultural capital, that is, how respectable we were in our tight-knit communities. And, you know, we're both from Cork City, Mick, and that's a very small, tight-knit community. So our second city, even, we both know, is incredibly small. I'd come back from town, my mother would say, who did you meet? And then we'd work out how to place them. So every single community in Ireland was a very small, tight-knit community. And the only way that we could differentiate each other from each other was around this kind of cultural capital of respectability. And girls and women bore a huge burden in terms of maintaining respectability so that the entire family could operate in these very close-knit circles. So, for example, if you got pregnant outside marriage, even in the 70s, when I was a teenager, your sister's prospects of marriage were going to be damaged. Your brother's prospects of promotion in the bank were going to be damaged. This was a shame you were bringing to your entire family. And I don't know if the report gets to that kind of information, because I suspect it doesn't, because of the way it just seems unable to deal with the testimonies that were coming towards it. I don't know if those were the kinds of questions that they were able or even thought to ask of the people who were so generously giving them their experiences.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Catherine. Small correction there. I'm not from Cork City, since you've known me, I was, but my family arrived there when I was a teenager. The point I was wondering, I think it's very interesting what you're saying about class, particularly in relation to those who ended up in the mother and baby homes. But I wonder, is there another issue there? And that is, because of the cultural Catholicism we had, was there more of an onus on what you might call the relatively small middle class educated at that time, as there wasn't much education in the country? Would there have been more of an onus at that level of society to shout stop, so to speak, in terms of how the place had turned into a theocracy? Or was the power of the church too great that not even them would have had a chance of standing up to it?
That's a great question. But again, Mick, you're making the distinction between the middle class and the church and the state. It was middle class Ireland who were in the church.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you couldn't be illegitimate and be a priest. You had to be respectable. Who do you think got preferred and promoted within the church? Who do you think ran the big religious orders? At the moment, I'm looking at doing some research on the history of the Magdalene in Donnybrook. And their mother superioresses were, you know, sisters and daughters of, you know, of defence forces generals. So they were the upper middle class or the respectable middle class. That's who the Catholic Church was. And again, you know, one of the things we haven't kind of properly talked about in Ireland is as you're mentioning, the kind of education. Even when free education came in, certainly for the education of girls, so there was very few, you know, girls' schools that demanded fees. But even in all of the free second level education schools for girls, there were class differences. So, you know, the Ursuline convents had a different clientele than the Presentation convent schools. And the training for all of those girls was how to take up a position within the, as understood it, within Catholic society. So having gone to an Ursuline school, which I enjoyed hugely, we were always told that our social role was to be charitable, to be generous, to be kind, to do good works, or corporal works of mercy. But there was this assumption, which was never clearly stated, was that, you know, we were the people who had the resources that could be given in that way. And so that leads to, you know, a hand-in-glove situation where, and again, because I had such a lovely experience, where it's almost impossible to think badly of the Catholic Church or its intentions towards those poor people. So you can say that the middle-class people were apart from the church and should have been whistleblowing. We were the leaders and shapers and makers of that church and the state.
Very good point. Yeah. Looking forward a small bit, Catherine, I mean, as you say, the main thing now is that survivors, adoptees, what they're entitled to, what they need in terms of basic primal needs, that everything should be done now to accommodate them in that respect. And I've heard some noises in the last few days even that some people are wondering whether the state today is up to meeting that. For example, particularly, there even seems to be an issue around retrieving their records and birth certs and whether or not there's an issue there in relation to privacy. And I have to say, I was a small bit suspicious when our old friend, the Attorney General's advice was thrown into the mix, because I've known in different areas of life that's something that can be used to prevent action. But I think some people are suggesting that there's not going to be an awful lot of rapid movement in that respect.
There should be. You know, there was a very interesting judgment that came out of February last year, the Habitat judgment, the Court of Appeal. And it stated that there's an unenumerated constitutional right to have one's identity correctly recognised by the state. And it was, again, specifically around one's personal birth identity. Of course, adopted people should have a right to their own birth cert. It is a publicly registered document and they should have it. End of. There's this fantasy that the Irish state tells itself that it was all about the protection of these unwed mothers. And it actually seems to believe that they made some kind of promise that these girls and women would never be contacted ever, and that their shame and their secrecy would be safe. Whereas actually, the only documents we've ever seen in that regard are where these mothers were, they had to promise never to try and trace and contact their children. We can't now pretend that the state really was around protecting or minding these girls and women. And also, you know, a birth cert doesn't kind of come with an address and a telephone number of who your natural parents were. So, of course, people should have that document. Whether or not they would choose to try and trace, if they can, their natural parents, and then take another step after that and make contact, that they're distinct issues and differences. They have a right to their personal identity. It's an unenumerated right in the Constitution. They have that right under the GDPR as well, as we've recently seen in various debates that we've had. Around unsealing all of these archives now gathered under various commissions. So therefore, that's the first thing that should be done, and it should be done a very simple amendment to the Civil Registration Act, just kind of copper fastening what is already recognised in as a right under the Constitution, but you're spelling it out legally that they have a right to go and get their birth cert, and that can be appended to any bill going through the Oireachtas these months. And that should be done immediately. And anybody who's worrying around balancing the rights to privacy of the mother, again, I just want to reiterate, there's no addresses or telephone numbers of the natural parents on those birth certs. So I don't see how that balancing of privacy can arise in that regard.
And in your experience, Catherine, do you sense any resistance to doing that in as quick a way as possible?
You know, I actually do think, just having had some Zoom meetings with the current minister, Roger O'Gorman, and with the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, that I don't, you know, they seem to think that something had to be done and that they did need to bring forward legislation. They have mentioned themselves publicly that they want to bring forward an information and tracing bill. As part of the CLON project, JFMR has provided them with a draft information and tracing bill drawn up by Claire McGettrick, Maeve O'Rourke, James Gallen and Mairead Enright. You know, offering it as a way to kind of kickstart the process. But I think in the first instance, if they really are serious about being measured by their actions, which the Taoiseach said he was, the immediate thing they could do is bring forward that amendment. And as we all know, you know, this idea that the Attorney General forbids it, well, come on. The advice doesn't mean that it has to be followed. There's plenty of other legal opinion out there, again, which we've provided them. We've given them legal opinion, and all of this is available on the CLAN website, the clanproject.org website. Very robust legal opinion, which talks about proportionate way of kind of balancing the rights of adoptive people and parents.
Yeah, and it's nothing to stop going ahead and doing it. And for example, if the president's advice, he can refer to the Supreme Court, and if not, it's still open there for anyone to challenge, and there's no reason why it can't be attempted in that respect. The other issue then is compensation scheme. You know, at this stage of life, as was pointed out in the report, very often adoptees and their mothers who are subjected to that, there's a stigma that sometimes lasts for life. And I think everybody would be in agreement there should definitely be some form of a compensation scheme. In your opinion, in terms of the other compensation schemes, would you be confident that this could be done to the satisfaction of the people who are involved?
No, based on the other schemes.
Right.
No. I mean, you know, unfortunately, the scheme I know best is the Magdalen Restorative and Redress Scheme. And the Ombudsman himself said it was the worst maladministrated scheme that he'd ever come across in his entire public service career. How it was laid out by Justice Quirk was, you know, it was an ex gratia scheme, and no judge wants to say that you know, the scheme that he's suggesting is ex gratia. But the details were quite good, in that the women were promised an equivalent card to the HAA card, which is a very, very good medical card. The HAA refers to the hepatitis blood contamination scandal we had. And if that card had been given, that would have been a very good redress scheme. But it was gutted. And they now have basically a medical card. And apparently, you know, this enhanced medical card, which is basically just a medical card, is what is being suggested. Again, it's unclear to me, are they talking about giving it merely to the natural mothers, or are they also talking about giving it to the adopted people? I'm not sure. There seems to be some quibble about, you know, whether there should be a cut-off date of 1973 or not. Would that be adequate compensation? I don't know. It's, you know, it's up to natural mothers to let us know whether or not they think it is. I suppose I'm more interested in other forms of restorative justice and redress. I'm more interested in, again, this is probably my bias, but given my, you know, my academic interests, I'm much more interested in talking about taking over some of these publicly owned institutional buildings, so Magdalens, mother and baby homes, industrial schools, reformatory schools, and making them sites of dark heritage where we can go and explore and have on our national curriculum exactly what happened to a huge percentage of our population. 1% of our population, Mick, we locked up by in the 20th century.
More than any other country, as far as I know.
Yeah. I mean, only the recent president of the United States has managed to top that in terms of the percentage of population that's currently being incarcerated. So, yeah, it's a terrible indictment. And we're still living with that legacy. There's many people who are directly affected by that still. So we do need to understand how that happened so that we don't replicate it in the future. Of course, many other countries have histories of incarcerating their poor, but nobody did it as effectively as us. So again, we need to take the lead in understanding that, even in international terms.
And again, even in terms of that aspect, and it's something that has come up again in particular, I think there's some controversial situations where I think there was a former Magdalen laundry in the inner city in Dublin that was going to be at one stage sold for housing. And other issues like that. And I mean, is it a question, Catherine, does it get to the stage that within the bureaucracy of the state, irrespective of initial financial will, that it's not, the financial will isn't there to drive it through, that these type of physical buildings should become, if not shrines, certainly education centres for future generations? Because it does seem a very obvious thing, yet It's not happening so far.
It's not happening so far, but again, you know, this Taoiseach Micheál Martin has publicly acknowledged, like last October and again in his apology, that this is somewhere that he wants to move into, that this is the kind of way in which he's thinking. And yeah, that site, that large campus in right in the heart of our capital city in Sean McDermott Street, it was actually going to be sold to a budget hotel, a Japanese budget hotel, whereby if the rooms they hadn't sold at midnight would be sold off for €35. And it was also one of these hotels where you could just, you know, digitally let yourself in and out. So you can just imagine what, you know, it would have been the old motto, come back again, I guess. So that site is still there. It's in public ownership. It's a very large site. It could certainly accommodate social housing, which I think would be a fine legacy. Because in having consulted with hundreds of Magdalen women now about the issue of memorialisation, one of the things they're most strong on is, and what should be done with former sites, is that if their families had more protection and more support, they wouldn't have ended up in Magdalen's. So housing and education are the two things that they stress really, really strongly. Yeah, it would be wonderful to have a truth-telling centre. And I am working on a project, full disclosure, which is suggesting that for that site, the Open Heart City project, largely run out of UCD. So we do have some young architects trying to consult and reimagine what a site like that could be, because it could be a multi-purpose site. So we could have museum, truth-telling centre. It could be the site of this national archive that so many politicians are now talking about, whereby once we release all of these commission massive archives now that we've gathered around these particular horrible sets of chapters of our 20th century history, we can collectively begin to interrogate and explore it there.
And Catherine, just to ask you then finally, you're familiar with a lot of Magdalen survivors and perhaps some of the people involved in the mother and baby homes in terms of your work. Do you sense, in general terms, that it has been cathartic for people who were through these places, how the state has approached it, notwithstanding some shortcomings in some areas, that finally there an acknowledgement there? Or is the state still falling short in that respect?
Yeah, I'm on, you know, WhatsApp groups with lots of people who were adopted and or gave birth in these institutions. And right now, it's just way too early. All the emotions are up. They're wrecked. They hadn't, you know, certainly since the leak, they haven't slept properly. So whether or not this proves to be cathartic for them, it's just a little bit too early to say. I think what would be cathartic would be measures of justice. And I think what would be cathartic would be to truly work to remove the shame and stigma. So in other words, not to faff around that we have to mind these shamed women and make sure that, you know, their children don't have their own birth certs, where I think it really is time that we put all of that shame away. And one of the ways in which we can most clearly do it is give out the birth certs and then have pronto, proper information and tracing legislation within this current session of the Dáil. And that will certainly, in the way that we saw the public apology for Magdalens and the redress scheme for Magdalens and the Dublin Honours Magdalens event, really, truly lift the shame. So we need processes of legislation and processes of public acknowledgement and memorialisation that will do what the Taoiseach said he really wanted in his apology, which was to shift the shaming onus being on the unwed mother onto the government and state and church and culture that did that shaming. If we're really going to see that, we need the follow through that he's promised.
Catherine, finally, some people have suggested that in years to come, we could well be in a scenario whereby the detail, the experiences of another institution, one that's with us currently, direct provision, that we could end up going back there sometime. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, we've been saying that in Justice for Magdalens since 2009 when we got together. You know, in fact, it was one of the motivations for us in keeping going with what many told us was a foolhardy task of trying to get justice for the Magdalens. We kept saying, what happened to Magdalens is still happening now. We have a huge part of our state apparatus is in fact voluntary run organisations that are for profit. So, you know, direct provision centres, one of the worst things about them is that they're for profit, most of them. And we have seen that when the profit motive comes into the so-called caring of our most vulnerable, that means that they don't get the care, the dignity and respect that they're entitled to because somebody's trying to make a buck. So we've always tried to show that the same mentalities, the same kind of desire of the state to hand off and say it wasn't us, it was the church or it was those people we've subcontracted out to, it's not us. And we saw it with the Louise O'Keefe case where they actually tried to say that they had nothing to do with the national education system. They weren't to blame for the abuse she suffered there. So that kind of mentality, which is deeply entrenched in our civil service, has led to the current direct provision centre where they really do think by farming it out to profit-making entities that they're no longer on the hook for it. So, yeah, and I think, you know, if there is a commission of investigation into the DP centres, I hope that commission isn't going to try and blame people like you and me, Mick, the vast majority of Irish society, which has been consistently and constantly telling politicians, we don't want direct provision, we think it's wrong, you're going to have to do a lot better. So society has been saying that loud and clear. And we need the politicians to take action. Of course, there's going to be crimes to answer for if they don't actually take DP seriously.
Catherine O'Donnell, thank you very much for joining us today. That's it, folks. I'd also like to thank our engineer, JJ Vernon. You can get the podcast on the usual platforms or let me know what you think at mick.clifford@examiner.ie or on Twitter at @mickcliff. See you soon. Take care.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.